Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do certain places become important to the communities that surround them, and what role can artists play in creating such spaces in areas that might otherwise remain mired in poverty? My guest today is artist and cultural planner Theaster Gates, who has applied his polymathic interests in music, food, sculpture, and urban revitalization not only in museum and gallery installations, but to a once down-at-heel pocket of Chicago's South Side. The idea is to bring diverse groups of people together to engage in deep conversations about culture and community. Theaster Gates is in town to speak tomorrow at 6:30 at O'Donnell Hall's Owen Arts Center on the SMU campus, and we are delighted he could make time to be here this afternoon. Theaster, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's great to be here.
So this term placemaking comes up often in discussions of your work. What does that mean exactly?
Placemaking is the activity necessary to take areas that have been maybe disinvested in for some time or for some reason is under-resourced. That activity helps to kickstart the creation of a place again. They're normally places that have people there that have real lives and real homes and working jobs. But they're also places that maybe lack culture, that maybe lack certain kinds of space-based amenities. And so I think as the country is trying to figure out what placemaking is, it seems like there are artists and organizations who are taking stabs at rooting themselves in a place, creating cultural community, and then those places gaining vibrancy as a result of those interventions happening.
It's interesting to me that in the great cities that we have in this country, in cities like Chicago, mm-hmm. in cities like Dallas and Fort Worth, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. And yet there are these pockets that sort of get left behind. And ultimately, sort of to what you're describing, they are victims of the fact that the only people who want to go there are the people who are forced by their economic situations to live there.
That's exactly right. One of the things that's really challenging is that I think people who are alike look for each other. And in an economy in our cities where people have more and more options, and the more resources you have, the more options that you have, people tend to aggregate around the resources that they have, leaving some places where if you don't have as much, it's harder to have some of those amenities that are in other neighborhoods. And so and what I found is that those neighborhoods that have been left behind, if you will, those neighborhoods, they often have amazing cultural wealth that's often under-recognized. So how can placemaking and how can we as artists and creative people simply amplify the beautiful cultural things that exist? And in my case, how do we look at the abandoned spaces in those places as points for amplification?
So when you talk about amplifying what is already going on there that is creative, that is good, I mean, you obviously have to walk a line between your great ideas as an outsider, even one who is invested in this community, and the organic ideas that spring up from within the community itself. How do you do that?
Yeah, you know, one way is by not predetermining what happens in that building that you're recreating. Mm-hmm. That if we have the ability to take space that we could say is neutral and then ask the question to those communities that I'm working in or that the team of us are working in, then the community might say, oh, well, you know, what we really need is a nursery space or a nursery school, or what we really would like to have is, you know, more local food or a music venue. We can assume that these are neighborhoods where there's always going to be a need for affordable housing. There's always going to be a need for jobs. But is there a way that my interest in culture could help create a new kind of space that, in addition to the need for jobs, there's also a celebration of the cultural wealth that's there?
So tell us a little bit about the Dorchester Project. Am I saying that right, Dorchester?
Yeah. So... 6 years ago, I moved to a place because I got a job and I wanted to live close. Mm-hmm. I bought a house. For 3 years, I lived in my house on Dorchester, and I was a neighbor to my neighbors. In that third year, it was 2008, and the housing market changed.
As we all know quite well.
Mm-hmm. a lot of my neighbors who had been renters lost their apartments because the people who owned those buildings probably also lost their mortgages. Mm-hmm. These were people who didn't necessarily live in the city or in the state. They were sometimes speculative developers who owned large portfolios of properties and simply lost them. So on my block, it went from maybe 80% occupied to somewhere near 40% occupied.
Which is scary, among other things.
It is scary. Mm-hmm. But and so the building next door to me was available. It was affordable. There was some concern about the misuse of the building. I acquired the building very cheaply. Mm-hmm. This story is the story of developers, that when markets fail, there's another kind of entrepreneur who it becomes very excited at the failure in the market, and they grab up a lot of buildings. Well, in my case, I wanted to think about this second building adjacent to my house as a cultural space. Is it possible to reimagine a two-flat building that had been for two families or three families as the beginning of a cultural hub in a neighborhood? Could I transform it and instead of creating rental units, use it for the block club party or dinners or live music? And so I tried. We spent 2 years slowly gutting the building and making sense of the building. And now that building, along with four others on the block, are a kind of hub of cultural activity. We have live music performances there. There's a library on the block that's kind of informal walk-in library. And soon we'll have a space called Black Cinema House, which is a space that celebrates the films of Black people throughout the diaspora. These small projects have been going very, very well. And then I knew that there were 36 units of abandoned low-income property that hasn't been used in about 5 years around the corner. And so I approached a developer in Chicago to see if I might partner with him to reimagine those 36 units as mixed-income artist housing. And we got approval from the Chicago Housing Authority that would be a great idea, and resources from the city to help make that happen. And so now we're at about 75% occupancy, 80% getting back up there, and we'll introduce 35 new families to the neighborhood over the next 2 years.
When you start to change the makeup of a neighborhood by bringing in, say, artists to a place where, were you among the only artists before when you originally moved in 2006?
I was of the most visible. Mm-hmm. I think that the neighborhood already had lots of creative people. But again, maybe people who wouldn't self-identify as artists necessarily, but yeah, like tinkerers or hobbyists. And the point you're making, my hope is that the artists who move to Dorchester are actually artists who already live on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that it's a little bit different from other forms of neighborhood transformation where you just let the market handle it and see what happens and artists will move in and there'll be new cafes and new sushi bars, that this is actually requiring some intentionality, that we're actually talking to artists who live on the south side about their needs, talking to artists throughout the city and saying, is the south side a place where you might be interested in calling home?
How does one artist influence another when they are living and working really close together as opposed to maybe meeting up once a month at a gallery space somewhere or meeting for coffee or something?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm learning in my own art practice is that I really need the sparring that happens in daily conversation, ongoing conversation about one topic or a set of topics. And sometimes it's hard when you're a working artist to have that kind of time during the day. Mm-hmm. What I'm finding is that, like, when I come home, if there's a neighbor who's an artist, and we can kick back and have conversation about the things that we're working on. Or if they're having a kind of success and I'm jealous of that success, that it rubs off, that I can say, oh man, how'd you get that grant, or how'd you get that exhibition? And then when there's a community of people, you find that there's artistic excess that can be shared. So people have differing skill sets. People have different schedules. People have different forms of cultural knowledge that really could help us all advance our practices. So I'm excited to kind of see how that works.
One of the things I know that you've been really committed to as you remake these physical spaces is taking reclaimed materials and found objects and incorporating them into the design. What is your thought in terms of sort of linking? Are you linking the past to the future or the past to the present, or are they seamless for you?
Well, that's a good question. I think in some ways, Chris, the materials that I extract from these abandoned buildings are meant to act like a trace to the past. Mm-hmm. They're meant to remind people that not only were buildings made from really amazing stock of stuff, but also that there's something really sad about the fact that the buildings have been left so long uncared for, unoccupied, that they would end up in this new use. But there's also something that's quite poetic about the use of the materials. That is, I'm not just creating sculptural objects that are about the wood that was in the building. I'm trying to use those materials in service to another idea, like the full potency, the potential of these materials to be beautiful things. And in the way that maybe we've disregarded the value of that place, how the art world adds new value and looks at these materials with new eyes, that is that the beginning of looking at that place with new eyes. So in some ways, the objects are always asking people to look again at the place where those things are from. Not for sympathy's sake, but maybe with a sense of possibility.
I guess it also, in a way, allows you to not feel bad if a building has to be razed in order for something else to be built in its place. If you're able to take some of those materials, it doesn't feel entirely like you're starting over.
That could be true. I mean, I do think that there's a way in which having an opportunity to identify a building that's maybe in line for demolition and saying, wait a minute, there's something really amazing that could happen with this building. That it's not just the preservationists who are concerned with old buildings, that artists and community members and families that may have lived in that building, that a building's history might actually have some real value. The challenge is, where do we find the resource in our poor communities to care for those buildings? And I think in some ways, I'm allowing a part of my art practice, just a portion of it, to be concerned with the ability to take those materials, put them back into the world and sometimes into the market. Whoa. And as a way of kind of making case for the right for that building to continue to live.
My guest is artist and cultural planner Theaster Gates. He's in town to speak tomorrow at SMU. If you'd like more information, you can find it at smu.edu/meadows. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Artist and cultural planner Theaster Gates is with us. He's in town to speak tomorrow at O'Donnell Hall's Owen Art Center on the SMU campus. That talk is at 6:30. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Theaster, I imagine there are people listening to this conversation that sounds that are thinking, it sounds great, I'm excited for what's going on, but I'm worried about this problem of gentrification, which is when you have the original low-income inhabitants of an area that is revitalized suddenly priced out of the neighborhood.
Sure. Complicated conversation, right? There's a way in which the practice that I've been observing, working on one building at a time, talking with my neighbors about what's possible, helping them to acquire buildings in the neighborhood for their children and grandchildren, that we've really taken a kind of slow cook approach to our reinvestment in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There are issues of scale and there are issues of class that come when you start to use a word like gentrification. I think that when you start to do 100 and 200 unit redevelopments and you get developers who, you know, to meet the bottom line, really have to lease at the highest rate possible, then it becomes really challenging to keep the existing fabric of a place. Now, to be honest, sometimes we don't want the existing fabric of a place to remain. There are times when gentrification is intentionally moving out one kind of people, one class of people, one race of people, to replace that with a new market, a new class. And that's a kind of more kind of traditional gentrification, that there's some intentional shift in a place. The work that I'm trying to do, and the reason why I think that it's a little bit more nuanced, is that I'm really interested in how can we, in a place that isn't immediately transforming into something else.
Right.
How can we look at the buildings that are abandoned in a city like St. Louis or Omaha or Chicago and say, wow, this is really amazing housing stock. What else can we do with it with the people who are already here? Who's interested in this kind of work? That might be a nice compliment. And there's a real intentionality. Now, I'm at a moment now where the opportunity to scale up is really possible. Places like Baltimore and Cleveland and Detroit that have large acres of unused buildings and lots of empty land, I'm having to give real thought to what are the possibilities of these buildings and spaces, and how can we think about the people who currently live as necessary participants in the kind of cultural growth possible in a place. And it's not always possible. And when it's not possible, I won't be involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but our cities, you know, in the Midwest and in other parts, I think that there are often racial and political implications to why neighborhoods change, why we need a new highway in a place, why eminent domain says that we need a park exactly where that neighborhood had been. And so I'm often finding myself in conversations with the political class saying, aren't there other ways that we can think about reinvestment without moving lots of people away?
Well, when you talk about the nuance of all of this and sort of understanding that it doesn't necessarily happen in a way that is clean or immediate, at the same time, when you say intentionality, that still speaks to now you are the guy with the money and the power or at least the resources or the connections to make things happen.
Sure.
And at some point, you're still in a position to make these decisions that will affect the people who have been there all along that may be delighted by what you're doing, but they're not really making the decisions themselves.
Well, two things. I think you're right that there is a kind of a kind of cultural and political influence that artists have. Especially artists who, you know, start to really kind of feel passionately about the things that they do. I try to be really careful with how I use that it really requires a kind of efficacy and the intentionality that I talk about. You know, I think that someone has to take a position in defense of people whose political voice is not often heard. Mm-hmm. And while I don't claim to be an activist or have an altogether revolutionary practice in the arts, I do think that places are special because places have history, and that people are carriers of those histories, and that they have the right to continue to make history as neighborhoods change. But I also believe that people have the right to leave when they want to leave. And there have been moments that you could look at neighborhoods in New York, Flatbush or Bushwick, or parts of Chicago and Wicker Park or Bridgeport, where they have been normal communities. People get older. They want to retire somewhere else. They want to sell their building. They want to sell their building at the highest price possible. And by not being intentional and only thinking about the market, then they're inviting a particular kind of new person to buy the building. And they have the right to sell the building, and the person who bought it has the right to buy it. But I think when I use the word intentional, is there a way in which we can give more thought to the implications of when we sell and why we sell, where we buy, why we buy? And that if you could add to the equation something other than the pursuit of wealth, like the maintenance of a historic place or the possibility of creating shared value and shared culture in a place, then maybe you can get to communities that don't immediately become homogenized, all this or all that.
Well, it's an exciting thing to think about because I think it sort of turns upside down a history we have in this country in our unfortunate past when, for example, during white flight, there were people who felt like people who moved out of the neighborhood had a responsibility, and I'm using tremendous air quotes here, mm-hmm. not to sell to what other residents of the community would have considered the wrong kind of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can trace people's kind of ethical decisions, good and bad, mm-hmm. whether they're the old housing covenants and racialized housing covenants of Chicago that wouldn't allow black people into certain neighborhoods, or just the opposite, that people sometimes sell buildings with the gift of equity, mm-hmm. that they're really intentional because they want to help create a particular kind of change. So when my parents first moved to Chicago, to Chicago's West Side, they bought their 4-unit building from an old couple they were a Russian Jewish couple, the last Russian Jewish couple in my neighborhood. The neighborhood had since become all African American, and the Jewish community that lived on that part of the West Side of Chicago, because of breakthroughs in civil rights, then the Jews could live on the North Shore and could live further north. And so the reality is my neighborhood that I know as all black had been German and then Russian Jew and then African American. Mm-hmm. And if we accept the fact that neighborhoods do really change and they go through, unfortunately, periods of decay, depending on a lot of circumstances and periods of tremendous restoration, I'm just really curious about what are the factors that go into that. And I think often public dollars help make things happen. Private dollars make things happen. But they make them happen often without deep consideration for some people. And so I think that the part of me that feels strong advocacy really thinks a lot about, okay, if resources are going to be spent by our cities, by our states, by the federal government, for lots of different kinds of people, how can I ensure that there's a mix and that the amenities that the wealthy get to enjoy, that also the middle class and the poor get to enjoy them as well?
Is it always easy for you to convince people, or has it been easy working on Dorchester Street? Did the neighbors think from the beginning this is a great idea and Theaster Gates will have success and we're delighted to have him working on this, or did it take a little doing?
Well, let's be real honest. I've met a lot of people around the country now as a result of my art practice. Mm-hmm. I go to Denver, and then the Denver trustees from the Denver Art Museum want to come to my house. There's 50 of them. Mm-hmm. They're all white. So a busload of all white people get off the bus, and they want to tour my block, my normal black working class community. My neighbor might come over and say, Theaster, who are all these people? And why are they here again? That there might be there. It's totally reasonable that as a result of my quote unquote celebrity, mm-hmm. that I've created a little bit of a circus on my block, let's say. But what's happened, and this is back to the point of intentionality. The reality is, if I moved from my block would never experience this kind of weird clash. And normally what people like me do when they get a little bit more cash is they bump up to the next neighborhood. But I think that's exactly where it starts to feel like the right kind of artistic cultural rub, Chris, mm-hmm. that there's this moment where I have to spend some time in advance with my neighbors saying, look, these people are coming from Denver. They're really nice. So I'm going to have a big truck outside. And in the same way that there might be a family reunion and the family reunion takes over the empty lot next door, mm-hmm. I'm going to have a group of white people who come from Denver who are really curious about this thing because Denver has some pockets where African-Americans and whites don't mix right. And they're really curious about ways that this Dorchester project might be a model for a particular kind of intentional reinvestment.
Does it bother you at all that this group of prominent white people who come from Denver, and we're just using them as an example, but that they would not be touring your interesting, vibrant neighborhood of African Americans if you didn't live there?
It does bother me. But it also is the call that I'm making to other artists who have national influence. That there should be a way in which we leverage this cultural moment that we have access to kind of shine a light on these communities that we're from or that we really believe in. That I know it has everything to do with the weirdo charismatic. And I'm trying to take advantage of that, not just for the good white folk from Denver, but also for the black middle class that lives in Chicago, mm-hmm. that didn't imagine that Dorchester was a viable place to live and raise their families because it wasn't safe and so and so.
So they wouldn't have been there either. That's really interesting.
Yes, yeah. The reality is, and this is awesome, that when people can live better, they choose to. Mm-hmm. When people can go from one housing stock to a better housing stock, why wouldn't they?
Sure.
When I talk a lot about civil rights. One of the interesting things about civil rights was that it meant that for those who had good jobs, they could now have better schools. Mm-hmm. They could now live in different neighborhoods. And they often moved to better neighborhoods, which happened to be white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Everyone who could leave, not everyone, many of the people who could leave the place where they were from did. That's no different from being from a rural town in Ohio or a small town in Texas, and going to the bigger city and getting a good college education and getting a great job. Who wants to go back to their small town? And very few people do. It's not until we're 80 and we're ready to retire and we go, man, we should go back. And so I'm just trying to say, if I could adopt as part of my artistic practice a politic of staying, that is, it's a political choice that as my cultural as cultural opportunities increase, as my friendships grow, as my position title changes at the University of Chicago, that I would actively stay where I am and be a good neighbor, whatever that means. And that you don't have to become a big service organization to do that. You don't have to become a big not-for-profit. I can just be a dude in a place and be as generous as I can to myself and my neighbors.
So, Theaster, when you're creating a work of art, wow. and I know you work in various media, mm-hmm. And that probably a lot of other things also come into play, but do you think of yourself first as using art to explore and understand the world and your ideas, or do you think of art primarily as a way to communicate ideas that are already fully formed for you?
Right. It's not either or. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a way in which being trained as a potter was really, really important to me. And having a youth where my father was a roofer and a kind of small property owner, that I found process to be really, really important. And that material, like clay or lumber, old wood, the materials that I'd use were really an opportunity to work out ideas. That process was really important. And in many cases, process was the work.
It matters more than the finished piece.
Yes. In my training and even now, that there's a part of me that feels like making the pot is the thing that's important. And then the fact that I can fire the pot and glaze the pot and sell the pot, that's all kind of a byproduct of this really amazing experience that I've had creating the thing. Mm-hmm. The same could be true with some of the more conceptual parts of my artistic practice, that gutting these buildings, hiring other people to work with me to create a small new economy, reprocessing and purposing those materials into other objects, that process is an expensive process that includes lots of people. And I think that I'm as in love with that process as I am the objects or the output of those things.
My guest this hour is artist and cultural planner Theaster Gates. He is in town to speak tomorrow at 6:30 at O'Donnell Hall's Owen Arts Center on the SMU campus. Find information at smu.edu/meadows. If you'd like to join the conversation, email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with artist and cultural planner Theaster Gates, who is in town to speak tomorrow at SMU. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Theaster, you talked about intentionality in the projects that you are doing in communities. Do you care who buys your work? Are you intentional with regard to the people to whom the work is made available?
Absolutely. My intentionality is coupled with my gallery's intentionality. And I think that there are times when in the art world, art market, who's important is a very complicated thing. That for an artist, you want museums to have access to the work. You want collectors who are connected to museums to have access to the work. And so sometimes there's a kind of my gallery has its own ethic, and I think that it's a good one. But then there are other times where, as a result of the priorities that are set, it means that some people might not ever have access to the work. Mm-hmm. And so it means then that there are other conversations that I have to have with my gallery and with the market about making sure that there's the people who started collecting my work 10 years ago when I made ceramic masks also have access to some of these other works. Mm-hmm. Now, because there's some politics and money involved, these things are often very, very complicated to negotiate. But I like that messy stuff so much, you know, that that it is important. There's also the reality of me being, a young professional artist. We try to be really careful to place things in places where they'll be loved and cherished, and not just viewed as commodities.
Not just an investment for later.
Not just an investment.
And we were talking during the break about the fact that there are times when you sell a piece to a collector who has the resources to sort of take what you've done and apply the same ideas in their own community.
Yeah, there are times when collectors who now know the story of Dorchester and know a little bit about the history of these materials become really interested and sometimes invested in what else is possible. How can we both buy the object, love the object, but also become stewards with me, stewards of Dorchester? And sometimes, is there room for Dorchester, the block, to become a model for a particular kind of reinvestment wherever they live? And so it's been fun to allow the narrative that grows as a result of those objects being in the world to inform new friendships and new conversations with my friends who happen to also collect art.
Let's go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have on the line now Michael calling from Sulphur Springs. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are y'all today?
Very well. Really good.
Really great conversation. I happen to be an artist who went into Christian ministry a few years ago, and a lot of the language I'm hearing our guests speak about is stuff that churches talk about as well, as far as intentionality and community building and social justice. Yet we sometimes fail at, or oftentimes don't really bridge the gap with the arts very well. And as sort of an artist slash pastor now, I'm very curious to see how communities of faith can work on similar projects, if not how you can see that working in the sort of similar way that you are building up communities and stuff and revitalizing neighborhoods.
Thanks for your call.
Mike, thanks so much. I guess this is a great moment to have some disclosure about when I studied urban planning, I minored in religious studies, thinking that some part of my urban planning practice might have home in the Black church. I found that the art world and the platform of the arts gave me more freedom to pursue this kind of complicated relationship with urban planning, arts engagement, community reinvestment. It was just my personal situation. But I think that there's a tremendous amount that communities of faith could do to help create vibrancy in communities. The challenge is sometimes there are moments where the matter of faith and the matter of community reinvestment become one matter. And the challenge that I've always given faith communities is it possible to have deep investment in culture and in place without also requiring conversion?
Mm-hmm.
And so these are things that I think about all the time, that there are moments when you just want the good work to be the good work, and that the acknowledgement of God and spirituality, those are things that are sometimes byproducts to my practice. That in a way, I really believe that my art practice is a practice of service, and the creativity that I have is part the books that I read and part deep cosmic and spiritual endowment. And I'm really thankful for that.
It does make sense in a way that in a lot of communities, the most organic place-made space that exists is a church.
Absolutely. I feel like most of my conversations, especially in Chicago and St. Louis, but also growing in Omaha, is the question of what is the role of the church in transforming communities and in communities that are going through some type of transition. what I found is that, say, the black church is often like the one place where people who no longer live in the neighborhood tend to come back. Mm-hmm. And they come back for Sunday service, then they leave and they go out kind of to wherever their nice new place is. And the church is still left in this community that might have some duress. And so I'm always curious, is there a way to reengage members of that congregation who may have a deep emotional commitment to that geography? Is there a way to reengage them in the reinvestment in that place?
So, in other words, there's a moral, with or without religion, there's an obligation to the communities one has left behind.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. And there's really amazing work where people who have gone out into the world become really successful. When asked, "What do I do with my resource?" the thing they want to do most is give it back to the place where they were from.
Hmm. Talk about this, if you don't mind. Reading your bio, I understand that you are the youngest of 9 kids and the only boy with 8 big sisters.
Yeah, it's true. There's I also think that maybe the evolution of my artistic practice and the number of people who I'm surrounded by daily has everything to do with being the kid that bumped around between, you know, my sister's hips and was always kind of called upon to be the kid that went to the store. But it was an amazingly vibrant breakfast table and dinner table. And there were always not just my sisters, but their boyfriends and their husbands and my nieces and nephews and our extended community. There were always a lot of people around. And I think I've built a practice that's so social because it's just kind of an extension of how I've always lived.
Yeah, it makes sense that you would need a sort of unique voice with which to express yourself even as a child.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Constantly. Well, I did like my sister's clothes and trying them on and that, but I was also very interested in establishing a voice of my own.
So food is a big deal for you, and you're not a trained chef, and yet you recognize the artistic potential, the cultural potential of exploring different cuisines. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, food. What I'm finding is that food is a really beautiful inlet for understanding more deeply culture and cultural nuance. And lots of people know that the dinner table is a place where culture is maintained, culture is transferred, and maybe culture is transformed. And so I've been attempting to use the dinner table and soul food as an opportunity to bring folk together who don't normally get together, and also maybe people with varied interests that are maybe complementary. And so in the way that a Victorian hostess from the 18th century might have placards that kind of intentionally put this duke next to this fine young lady, that I feel like there's a certain amount of curatorial practice that I'm engaged in when a friend says, "I have need," and another friend says, "I have excess," trying to connect those two friends so that they can give each other some support.
We have an email here from Christopher who writes, "Have you engaged city, state, or federal entities to provide incentives to local business that help them to be engines that drive change?"
Yeah, I think this question is kind of where the work is going next. That there's at the national level, with the National Endowment for the Arts, with HUD rethinking its policies on affordable housing and thinking about how we can't just think about housing, but we have to think about the whole person. And as a result, we have to think about how people engage the commercial environment, that I'm really advocating for a new way of imagining the amenities that are needed in a place and the role that local businesses play in it. Also, there's a way in which I think the venture capitalism community has really understood that there are moments when one needs to take risks And sometimes those risks will have great reward and consequence, and other times you'll try things that aren't always successful. I think that there has to be an incentivized way that our cities and private individuals start to invest more in culture, with the understanding that that investment could create new businesses, restaurants, small cultural spaces, new music venues, new churches, new artist-led communities. And they have to expect that not all of them will be absolutely successful, but many of them will. And I'm also putting that on the philanthropic community, that if our cities are going to be successful again, and especially those parts of the city that have been so largely left out of growing economies, it's going to require risk on all of our parts. And in my case, I call it artistic risk. I know that there are some people who feel like they can't afford to lose, that if we make an investment, we need it to work. But I think as a result, things get really cookie cutter really fast. Mm-hmm. So how can we encourage a celebration of local cultural commercial activity? It's a big question for me now. Right now, I'm myself incubating small businesses. Friends of mine who are in the cultural community who have great ideas, I want to help them start those things up. And it may be $1,000, it might be $5,000. And then can I invite other friends of mine in to say, look, this is a really great idea. It would be great in this storefront. Or there's an existing great shop that really needs a new awning and some new windows, and it might help a whole lot. Let's reinvest in that thing that already exists.
Briefly, we just have a little over a minute left. I know that you work with students at work, and of course you're speaking to students tomorrow at SMU. Talk about the kind of energy that you see in what are now called the millennial generation.
Yeah, this is a great question, because I think part of it is what are we teaching in our schools that might create a new kind of person in the future that can be more responsive? And what are young people made of these days? And what I'm finding is that they have a lot fewer hangups about race and mm-hmm. space than we do as older folk. And they're more willing to say, I want to be in the most interesting, most exciting, most daring, weirdest place in the country. How can I leverage my youth and my resources to do something good wherever? Mm-hmm. And that energy, I really think we have to learn to harness it. You know, we really have to figure out a way that we respect the fact that the boundaries and hedges that we had, that the millennials don't have it. And can we use that energy and openness for some substantial change that happens in this country?
You can learn more about Theaster Gates and his work at theastergates.com. He will be speaking tomorrow on the SMU campus at 6:30. Find information about that appearance at smu.edu/meadows. Theaster, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, Chris, it's my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.